ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 8th of April. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Australia's supermarket giants face multi-billion dollar fines under a mandatory code of conduct being recommended to the federal government to protect consumers and producers and rein in the power of the sector. That's the interim finding by former Labor Minister Craig Emerson. But he's rejected the idea of giving the government the power to break up the likes of Woolworths, Coles and Aldi to dilute their market share if they're caught abusing their market power. What does it mean for consumers dealing with cost of living pressures? I spoke earlier with senior business correspondent Peter Ryan. Peter, Craig Emerson's recommending big fines against the supermarkets if they're caught abusing market power. How would that work?
Well, Sabra, this would really hit where it hurts and put Coles, Woolworths, Aldi, the wholesale supplier Metcash, on notice for potential financial pain. The interim review of the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct by economist and former Labor Minister Craig Emerson, if adopted, would give the ACCC additional powers to take the supermarkets to court and seek fines of the greatest of $10 million or 10% of their annual turnover for major or systemic breaches of the mandatory code. For Woolworths, which has an annual turnover of around $50 billion, that would be $5 billion. The big problem here is that the current code of conduct is voluntary, not mandatory. It was drafted by the supermarkets themselves in 2015 to deal with complaints and public anger about the treatment of suppliers. But there are no penalties for these breaches, and there are onerous requirements for suppliers to get justice or compensation. This review was commissioned earlier this year when the supermarkets were accused of failing to pass on savings to consumers, even though wholesale prices for meat, fruit and vegetables are falling.
Peter, the Greens and the National Party say that fines aren't enough, that the supermarket giants should be forcibly broken up if they're caught abusing their market power. Why has Craig Emerson rejected that idea?
Well, Sarah, this wasn't part of Craig Emerson's original brief, but he's found breaking up the supermarket giants, forcing them to divest or sell, is populist and could end up triggering store closures and jeopardise thousands of jobs. The Prime Minister has previously dismissed this proposal as dangerous, saying we're not in the old Soviet Union. But there are concerns too that if major investors see that sort of government intervention, they might decide to sell up and go elsewhere. Craig Emerson told RN Breakfast the calls for break-up powers lack credibility and might damage competition.
You know, it's one of these, frankly, populist ideas. Oh, yeah, that's a good idea, break them up. Well, who do you sell the stores to? So let's say it's Coles who gets hit by forced divestiture. Are they going to sell to Woolworths? What does that do for market concentration? And if they say, well, no, you can't sell to Woolworths because that will increase market concentration, who do they sell to? Oh, well, maybe a foreign multinational, but they don't want to come here. And so the only options then left to start to closing stores, which would terrify their workers, but for the customers, for the shoppers, they'd say, oh, thanks for nothing. You know, like we got all the, we had a local Woolies or a Coles and it's been closed. So I just can't see the sense of it at all.
Former Labor Minister Craig Emerson and before him, Peter Ryan. Plans to shut down Australia's 20-year-old 3G network could be derailed over safety concerns. Soon, the big telecommunications companies are due to switch off their 3G networks to make room for data-hungry 4G and 5G technologies. That means devices that rely just on 3G will no longer work. But the ABC can reveal more than a million 4G handsets could also be caught out in the shutdown, preventing users from making emergency calls. Here's National Regional Affairs reporter Jane Norman.
Okay, just coming down to Fletcher's Creek, leaving the Bungles.
Running a four-wheel drive tour company in Western Australia's vast Kimberley region, Ed Bennett clocks more Ks than your average driver, navigating natural wonders and mobile black spots.
We just actually drove back up from Perth to Broome in the Kimberley, and 90% of the time on that travel, that was all on 3G.
Soon, 3G will be switched off. TPG closed its 3G network in December. Telstra's is due to shut down on the 30th of June, and Optus will follow suit in September. In the lead-up, the telcos have been rapidly upgrading their 3G sites. But outside bigger towns and cities, coverage often defaults to 3G, and that's what Ed Bennett is worried about.
If you don't have these services and something's happened, then it could be life-threatening.
Especially if you have the wrong device. Once 3G is switched off, mobile phones that rely solely on 3G will no longer work. Telstra estimates about 113,000 customers are still yet to upgrade their handsets despite the looming deadline. Optus wouldn't provide AM with a figure. But of greater concern to the federal government is a subset of older 4G handsets, which, because of the way they're configured, may not be able to call emergency services once 3G is switched off. Communications Minister Michelle Rowland was briefed in March and provided this update to Parliament.
I was recently briefed and learnt that up to 740,000 devices may be impacted. Immediate action is needed, and that's why I've tasked mobile operators to establish a new working group so industry collectively acts to improve their customer and handset identification.
1 month later, following the first meeting of that working group, the number of devices potentially affected has been dramatically revised up to over a million. In a statement, Michelle Rowland says she'll have more to say on the 3G shutdown soon and hasn't ruled out a delay, if warranted, in the public interest.
There is no definition other than negligent.
David Coleman is the Shadow Communications Minister. He's accused Michelle Rowland of acting too slowly.
The government received many warnings during 2023, particularly around the issue of emergency calls. But according to the minister, she didn't find out about this until March 7, the risks, and that is just extraordinary.
Shadow Communications Minister David Coleman ending Jane Norman's report. 6 months into the Israel-Hamas war and there's no end in sight. The Israeli military has announced it's withdrawn most of its troops from southern Gaza, leaving a small number behind as it prepares for a promised operation in Rafah, as well as a possible war on its northern front with Lebanon. Correspondent Lauren Day reports from Jerusalem.
With protesters again taking to the streets of Jerusalem, Israel is increasingly divided domestically, isolated internationally, and now preparing for the possibility of war on two fronts. But its Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says this is what winning looks like.
Today we mark 6 months since the war started. The achievements are great. We eliminated 19 out of 24 of the Hamas battalions, including senior commanders. We are one step away from victory, but the price we paid is painful and heartbreaking.
Despite that price, he's not backing down and has refused to meet Hamas's conditions for a ceasefire, including a full Israeli withdrawal and permanent end to fighting in Gaza.
Surrendering to Hamas's demands will allow it to try to repeat the crimes of October the 7th again and again, as it's promised to do. Instead of international pressure being directed at Israel, which only causes Hamas to harden its positions, the pressure of the international community should be directed against Hamas. This will promote the release of the hostages.
The loved ones of those hostages, like 26-year-old Ziv Aboud, whose boyfriend was kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival, says that needs to be the highest priority.
I'm sure that a lot is being done to bring them back, but we need more effort. We actually need to do more things in order to release them, because apparently what we're doing is not enough.
6 months in, Israel's also losing the support of some of its strongest allies, particularly in the wake of last week's airstrike that killed seven World Central Kitchen workers in Gaza, including Australian Zomi Frankham. The charity's founder, Chef Jose Andres, has reiterated his calls for an independent investigation.
Obviously, this was a target that we could argue that the first one, let's say, was a mistake. The second, the third.
Half a year of war has also taken a devastating toll on Gaza. There are shortages of food, water and fuel. Children are dying. The health system has all but collapsed. The military has now withdrawn all but one brigade in the enclave as it prepares for a promised assault on Rafah and possible war on its northern front with Lebanon. Palestinians have finally been able to return to Khan Yunis to inspect the damage and debris where their homes once were. Local resident Salim Sorab is shocked by what he finds.
I miss it. I miss my town. I miss Khan Yunis. I miss it. My soul is here, but my body was not. But my soul is here.
This is Lauren Day reporting from Jerusalem for AM.
The federal government's appointed the former chief of the Australian Defence Force, retired Air Chief Marshal Mark Binskin, its special advisor to examine last week's Israeli strikes, which killed Australian aid worker Zomi Frankham and six of her World Central Kitchen colleagues in Gaza. The Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, says Mr. Binskin will tell the government whether any further action could be taken to ensure a full and transparent investigation and to hold those responsible to account. And soon on RM Breakfast, Sally Sarah will interview Professor Ben Saul, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights and Counterterrorism. That segues nicely into our next story. With the rise of disinformation and extremism, a group of academics is urging all of us to better educate ourselves and in turn help strengthen our communities. Isabel Masali reports.
You don't need to search too far for examples of conspiracy theories jumping from online to real-world harm.
Six people are now dead after a horrific shooting and siege in the Western Downs in which two young police officers were executed in cold blood.
But people aren't radicalised overnight, and conspiracy theories are becoming increasingly mainstream, according to a group of academics known as the Perth Extremism Research Network, or PERN, who study them closely. Dr. Ben Rich is the director.
Issues around extremism are sort of portrayed as exceptional and requiring exceptional, often quite heavy-handed responses on the part of the authorities, on the part of the state. Unfortunately, these conditions are actually a lot more normal than we wanted to believe, and oftentimes I think we're kidding ourselves. So we want to move away from perceiving these as a state of exceptionalism, but we also want to emphasise the point that this is a question around public health and that we all have a role to play in that.
And if that sounds challenging, well, you're not alone. The PERN team of about 15 experts have developed a range of free educational resources for the public to learn about conspiracy theories, how they develop and how to counter them. Its resources are also aimed at informing community leaders, workplace leaders, teachers and police. Along with practical tips, it aims to build understanding of extremism and disinformation. That's false information spread deliberately.
With the idea that the more people are aware about this, the more comfortable they are in responding to it. And then the more they're able to, say, for instance, come up with, you know, sort of gentle counter arguments that, you know, maybe perhaps challenge a view, but also in a way that doesn't alienate the person articulating it.
Some of the topics covered include the growth of online misogyny and so-called sovereign citizens, people on the extremist fringe who don't recognise laws. Here's Dr. Sian Tomkinson, who's part of the PERN team, in an episode on white supremacy.
Push back against these beliefs, but try to avoid attacking the character of the person directly. It may harden them against you rather than keep them open to discussion.
Professor Deborah Smith is a research fellow specialising in extremism at Victoria University. While not part of the PERN project, she warns the threat has significantly changed in recent years, and those most susceptible are younger.
So I think building that sort of approach where we don't just leave it to the police at the end, but we look at how we can actually address the problem at various levels before it becomes too harmful and a policing matter is where we need to be moving, particularly as we're, you know, we have younger people getting involved. This becomes even more important.
The resources can be found on the PERN website and was funded by the US Consulate in Perth and Curtin University.
Isabel Masali reporting. Parts of New South Wales have been declared natural disaster zones after the biggest rainfall in 30 years. Thousands of people have been evacuated from their homes. More than 140 were rescued from floodwaters after Friday night's torrent, which has extended north from Sydney to the city's western fringe at Hawkesbury and south to the Shoalhaven area. And as Annie Guest reports, some communities remain isolated.
With almost 25 centimetres of rain in 24 hours, Darks Forest, southwest of Sydney, copped one of the biggest drenchings. Ian Coutts runs a bed and breakfast there.
It was windy. It was just heavy torrential rain. We had no power. The power was out It was pitch dark. We could not see anything inside or outside. It was eerie and just torrential for hour after hour after hour.
This elevated location escaped flooding, unlike the nearby Illawarra, where there were 70 flood rescues and at least 14 homes inundated. The Wollongong Mayor, Gordon Bradbury, describes the city's northern suburbs as the worst hit.
Quite a few homes were inundated, as well as the streets covered with debris, silt and mud. The city is still yet in the midst of the clean-up.
Wollongong is among 13 local government areas that have been disaster declared, and Councillor Bradbury welcomes the state and federal government assistance for the clean-up and repairs.
It's been quite an experience, and what's more, it seems to be becoming more frequent. This is the issue. These east coast lows are becoming more intense with a lot more rainfall and certainly impacting upon our community.
200 kilometres northwest, the Blue Mountains community of Megalong remains isolated by a landslip blocking its only access road. A helicopter is on standby to supply essentials if needed, while geotechnical experts work to fix the problem. Further east, evacuation orders were issued along the Hawkesbury River, but the Mayor, Sarah McMahon, says it's not yet known how many homes were flooded.
Not at this stage. It's too early to know those kind of numbers, but I have had residents and farmers calling me consistently over the last few days, just absolutely distraught with what's ahead of them over the next couple of weeks.
What do you say to those residents and farmers?
Oh, it's very upsetting to hear. This is the state government's jurisdiction and they need to please, I am begging them to please give us something in terms of the direction they will take for mitigation.
The New South Wales government earlier scrapped plans to raise the Warragamba Dam wall, arguing it would cost $2 billion. The Premier, Chris Minns, defended the decision on Saturday, arguing almost half the floodwater in the catchment doesn't come through the dam. The community was last month asked for its input on a regional disaster plan aiming to improve flood preparedness in the Hawkesbury-Nepean Valley.
Annie Guest reporting. Australian winemakers say the hangover from China's trade barriers will take years to recover from. The Chinese government's recent removal of export tariffs marks the end of a four-year trade dispute. During that time, new markets have had to be found for nearly 1.5 million litres of Aussie wine at lower prices, and it's caused havoc in the industry. John Daly reports.
Take a bit out of the barrel there.
This year's vintage tastes a whole lot better for West Australian winemaker John Griffiths. Now, the trade dispute with China is finally over.
What's fantastic news?
He runs a small winery in Perth's Swan Valley and says the last few years have been tough.
Yeah, it affected everyone. So in the very first instance, little wineries like ours, we just continued on. It didn't seem to bother us. But eventually it filtered down and it's affecting everyone, just that oversupply situation.
John Griffiths hopes bottles from this year's vintage may eventually make it to retail shelves in China. It all stopped suddenly back in 2020 when the trade dispute kicked off, leaving 1.4 million litres of wine without a buyer.
We basically got bargained down on price. It was very hard to raise our price in a situation where the buyer, a supermarket chain or a liquor store chain, could go and buy another wine cheaper from someone else.
In South Australia's Barossa Valley, the supply and demand issues are perhaps most acute. South Australia's Wine Grape Council Chair, Adrian Hoffman, says the lower cost producers are particularly hard hit.
You know, I don't want it to be a race to the bottom, but it seems like, you know, that's where we're heading at the moment, because everyone's undercutting the next person to make that sale. And for a lot of grape growers, it's actually non-profitable at the moment to be growing that fruit.
The fifth-generation wine grape grower says the reopening of the Chinese market won't solve the industry's issues with oversupply, but it will help.
Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be the absolute silver bullet that we're looking for. It'll definitely help. It'll flick that pressure switch off.
China's wine market has dried up in recent years as people have endured harsh COVID lockdowns. Adrian Hoffman again.
Because they were locked down for so long, their drinking habits have changed. The market isn't as big. It's not as affluent as what it once was.
That won't stop the industry from launching a charm offensive on Chinese wine drinkers. Tours are already being organised for later this year, and Wine Australia is guiding winemakers through new regulations and requirements for export. WA winemaker John Griffiths says he and others are wary of the risks, though.
Yeah, we realise it's a market that can change overnight through government policy.
A trade dispute the industry may take years to recover from.
John Daly reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Tesla has dominated the electric vehicle market for years, but watch out Elon Musk, because a Chinese model is giving it a run for its money. And the good news is it's a lot cheaper. Today, EV expert Dr. Gail Broadbent from UTS on whether that means your next car might be a Chinese-made EV. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.